John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
And joining us is Michael Bumpus. And getting his reaction, Michael, what did you think of the Jamal Adams trade? Did they give up too much? Did you like what they get in return? Or is it a win-win for both teams?
I think it's a win-win for both teams, John. You look at it, you're going to say, okay, two first-round picks, a third-round pick, and then you give a McDougal. I understand that. I get that. But you're getting a first-round pick. You're getting a guy who's proven, a guy who's had 6.5 sacks last year, 10 tackles for loss, a guy who brings fear in the middle of the field when it comes to playing defense and receivers going across the middle of the field. And if you're the Jets, you got a deal. You get two first-round picks, a third-round pick, and a guy to hopefully replace the guy you just sent over to Seattle. So I know people on the West Coast may think that the Hawks gave up too much. Maybe they did, but in all reality, this guy's going to pay off. He's proven. You don't have to wonder what he's going to be. You know who he is already, and he's only getting better, John.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, it drives me crazy. I don't know if it does for you. When I keep on hearing that criticism of, and I'll total it up here maybe during a break or something like that, is like, okay, Seahawks haven't drafted a first-round pick who's gone to the Pro Bowl since 2010. Okay, so understanding they've traded away a lot of their first-round picks, which was wise. But when you go through the list, and particularly, it was a little bit easier back in before 2014 or so. But since 2015 and on, you're lucky to get two Pro Bowlers at all. So it's like, okay, so I would have to think, and I've told her just in my mind right now, there may have been in the last six drafts maybe 10 players that have gone to the Pro Bowl, drafted 21 to 32, with the idea that the Seahawks are going to be a playoff team every year, drafting between 21 and 32. And people don't get the idea that it's like, okay, picks 21 through 32, technically in scouting divisions, are pretty much second round picks.
Yeah, and that's it, John. And I think people also don't realize that this drafting is a gamble. You really don't know what you're going to get. You're hoping that guys develop. You're hoping that their game transfers to the NFL. But most of the time, that doesn't happen, especially early. Back in my day, John, when you can get paid $50 million coming out as a rookie, a lot of these guys get that money, and now they're good. You know, the motivation is different. And in my opinion, that's why you see a lot of guys in these later drafts, later rounds, the fourth, fifth, sixth. Those guys, a lot of those guys end up being franchise-type guys because they come in humble. They're still grinding. They haven't made the millions upon millions of dollars that these guys are working for. So, no, I'm okay with it, John. And you also hit on it. You expect the Seattle Seahawks team to be good. And if they are good, they're going to draft later in the first round. They're going to rely on the second and third round pick. So I'm okay with it. On paper, it may be overwhelming for some, but if you break it down like you did just, John, it makes complete sense.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, it's like it really started in about 2015. And so what I just looked up, because I keep a chart of this, because it's driving me crazy how people go crazy on this. There's only been like about five or six first-round picks that have gone to the Pro Bowl between 21 and 32. And so you go to the different cities around football, and you go, it's like, oh yeah, well, these guys haven't taken a first round pick that's been a playoff team since. It's like, yeah, well, which of the five do you not get? It's like, I don't get that part of it.
Unless you're drafting a franchise quarterback, right? Unless you're the Bengals or the Miami Dolphins, like those are the picks that are really important to your franchise. Every pick is important, but we all know you can't win without a quarterback. Now, if the Seahawks were in a position where they needed a quarterback, then I look at this differently. But we all know the Seahawks have maybe the best quarterback in the league on their team. So now it's about getting pieces that are going to help him. And getting a Jamal Adams on defense is going to help Russell Wilson because it helps that defense. It allows that defense to buckle down on third and short or even third and long and just get out of sticky situations that they really couldn't get out of last year.
It's interesting because, again, the fact that go back to the Malik McDowell move, because remember they traded down about 10 spots. They ended up getting four guys that ended up making the team as far as draft choices, and one, Shaquille Griffin, went to the Pro Bowl last year, and Chris Carson now is a top 100 player according to NFL Network. It's like, okay, so they didn't get the Pro Bowl player in round one because they traded down, but they got two players right now, one a Pro Bowler in Griffin and another who is a pretty good running back. So it's like, it drives you crazy. It's like, will you pay attention?
Hey, John, everyone doesn't have the knowledge that you have, John. You know, that's why you're here to break it down for all of us and to calm everyone down. And I'm with you, John. I like the trade. I think it makes this defense that much better. And could you imagine if Quentin Dunbar is available as well? I mean, this secondary is looking awesome. You already have a solid linebacking crew. And yes, that defensive line doesn't look the way that you want it to look. But believe it or not, John, they got better on that defensive line when it comes to sack totals and whatnot. Now to see if a couple of guys can develop and help this defense on that D-line.
Well, it also got better from the standpoint, what was it? Did Bobby Wagner have about 6 sacks last year? Well, and Jamal Adams had 6 sacks. So basically, they've added, 3 players, with Bruce Irvin and Benson Mayoa, they've now added 21.5 sacks to this defense.
Yeah, you're right. It's all about name recognition. That's where people are kind of losing it when it comes to that defensive line because there's not that big name that pops out. But you look at the stats. Mayoa had 7.5, 8 last year. Irvin had 7.5, 8 last year. You bring in Jamal Adams, who had 6.5. And maybe bringing in the Jamal Adams will help Ken Norton and Pete Carroll believe in blitzing a bit more. You know, they didn't. I looked at the film and I watched McDougal and Jamal Adams execute the same blitz. Now, McDougal came up with a sack, but it just looked different. I see Jamal Adams come off the edge and sack the quarterback, and he's delivering a blow. It's not a tackle, John. He's trying to knock this dude out. And if you bring in a guy who does that rep after rep, it wears down on the defense, and that's what I'm hoping he continues to do.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And I think there's a good chance that he can do it. And so now it's a matter of seeing about Clowney. And again, because everybody's taking the position, it's like, oh, defense is no good. Clowney, you're bust. And, Clowney, I don't think has any plans right now to do anything soon. I mean, and whether it's going to be Seattle, Tennessee, or whatever. And, in some ways now, as bad as it's been for him and how he's mismanaged his free agency, not as bad as Le'Veon Bell, but you can say it's in the same conversation. But, now with the opt-outs, you can see if one defensive end opts out, maybe that can help him out. And if, let's say, for example, we've got the Vic Beasley story because he hasn't reported to camp yet. He says he's going to be there, but he's not. If he opens it up, then, Tennessee might be the team that can pay him a little bit more or come closer to what he wants.
Yeah, when it comes to Clowney, John, I just don't know what to think anymore. It's unfortunate. I don't think he handled this offseason perfectly. I don't think anyone ever does. But then you add COVID and not being able to go work out for teams and take physicals and stuff. It just put him in a bad position. And I think he thinks he's doing what's best, I think he thought he did what was best for him in that situation. And you can't knock a man for that. He's the only one in that situation. We don't know what he is going through. But it's unfortunate that it's gotten to this point with him because he is a guy that should be off the market already. But with all this stuff going around, I'm sure he's had multiple offers on the table. We know that he has. There's still a chance. The Hawks cleared a little bit of cap room. So we'll see if Seahawks are back on the table when it comes to Clowney.
No doubt. So how do you feel for this team coming in right now? How good can it be?
John, I have this team picked to win the division. And you look at this division, you look at Arizona's gotten better. I think the Rams will finish in the bottom and the top. I mean, yes, Rams finish in the bottom. I think Arizona will finish in third. And it's up to the Niners and the Seahawks. But I feel like the Seahawks have gotten better. And I feel like the Niners have kind of plateaued. And the tipping factor is always the quarterback position. And the 49ers lost to Debo Samuel. He'll miss a couple of games. Sanders is gone. So they're going to rely on Kittle. There's some things going on over there. I didn't see this team make moves that made me believe that they're going to get better. I think they'll be a really good football team. But with this Seattle Seahawks team, it was all about that defense. Can they get better on defense? Can Russell Wilson get some help on the other side of the ball? And I think they're doing that. So I think they can win this division. They should be the favorites to win this division and hopefully get a number one seed. But we all know how tough the NFC is.
Yeah, it really is. And of course, New Orleans, I think, is really good. I think Green Bay is going to drop off a little bit. Minnesota definitely has some problems. Philadelphia, I mean, Dallas can be real good, and they better be good this year because they may have to break up the team after the season.
Man, Dallas is always good on paper, right?
Yeah. Oh,
look at that team on paper, and they look good. But, again, it's all about execution. How happy is Dak going to be? Is Zeke going to stay focused? What's Amari Cooper going to look like? What's Gallup going to look like? Preseason, we can have all these favorites. The Buccaneers look good on paper. They should do some things. And that's where the Seahawks, what I love about the Seahawks is that on paper, sometimes you'll look at them, you'll be like, all right, that's an okay team. But they're a team. They don't have all these crazy personalities. It's kind of like they all rally around Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson, and everyone knows their job. And with football being the most complete team sport, that's the approach that I would like to take. Now, I think the Buccaneers will have success. I think other teams will have success. I just like the style of the Seahawks.
Yeah, no doubt. I think that's going to be kind of fun to watch. And so, Michael, I always thank you. And, of course, I hope you have a good day. Are you going to enjoy the sun at all? Or?
Yeah, I'm getting out this weekend, John. I'm going to take the kids out to the coast and try to relax a bit. You enjoy your weekend, sir.
Okay, Michael, and have a great, safe weekend. Enjoy. Thanks for joining us and listening to the show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we'll get out the report card. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time for the report card with the professor.
In the report card, we look at the good, the bad, the ugly, the smart, the stupid, what people say, what people do. We take the stories, we take the anecdotes, we take the social media comments, we also take the voices, and we attach a grade to it. And so, Curtis, you give us a report card every day. Let's do it today.
All right, John. Well, let's start off with the NFL Top 100 list. We came to the conclusion of the 2020 list last night. And Russell Wilson ranked number two on the list. And I think a lot of Seahawks fans would agree that Russell Wilson is at least a top two player in terms of not just quarterbacking, but also just position, regardless of position. But I think the big problem is the big problem today with the list is who was ranked ahead of him. And that would be Lamar Jackson getting the number one spot ahead of Pat Mahomes, who I think a lot of people would assume is a better quarterback than Lamar Jackson, even though Jackson was last year's MVP. Mahomes has an MVP. He's got a Super Bowl under his belt in just 3 years as a starter. John, how are we grading who was ranked ahead of Russell Wilson on the NFL Top 100 list?
I know that he was the MVP, but I think they're rushing to conclusions. Because, again, how can you put Lamar Jackson, even though he won 14 games, even though he was the MVP, ahead of Russell Wilson and Patrick Mahomes? I mean, Mahomes and Wilson should be number one and number two. You know, Lamar's still learning. He's got a good team behind him. You know, they did everything right last year. But I don't get the idea that he's number one. Again, I can see the popular vote, but I think it's an overvote. I'm going to give it a C-.
Yeah, I don't get Lamar Jackson being number one overall. He doesn't have a playoff win under his belt in his career yet. I think he is worthy of a top 10 selection. I think he is an incredible player in his own right. But to put him ahead of Russell Wilson, who has so many playoff wins and a Super Bowl under his belt, and also, you know, one of the best regular season quarterbacks, and to put him ahead of Pat Mahomes, who already in year three has accomplished more than any quarterback, you know, through 3 years. I'm going to give it a D+ to put Lamar Jackson as the number one player on the NFL Top 100 list, especially ahead of Wilson and Mahomes.
Yeah, it's rushing things. I don't go with that one at all.
It's very bizarre. John, also on the report card today, Major League Baseball announced yesterday that Dodgers reliever Joe Kelly would be suspended for 8 games, and Dodgers manager Dave Roberts would get a 1-game suspension for Kelly's role in Tuesday's scuffle with the Astros organization. So, John, how are we grading Major League Baseball suspending a Dodger player, and yet still no Astros players have received any kind of punishment from Major League Baseball?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to give my usual F to Rob Manfred, but yeah. I'm honestly going to give this one a B. Okay. And here's my thinking on this. It's like, okay, because, you know, everybody was saying that, oh, yeah, the Mariners should start throwing at the Astros. It's like, no, this team is trying to develop pitching. And so it's like, particularly after the Kansas City fiasco where, you know, the three Astros were hit, are you trying to win games, develop players, or try to get revenge? And I would have to think revenge is right down the list, not up the list. And so I think I give this one a B just because you knew if any one of the Mariner pitchers was going to throw, particularly with the alert being out there, it's like, don't throw at the batters, that it was going to be a suspension of probably about 8 games. And do you really want to take, you know, with only 60 games and 10 starts apiece for the guys in the Mariners, take 2 starts away from them? That would have been silly. And so it's like, okay, yeah, Joe Kelly, you're a hero. Good for you. I mean, you got a Dodger team that's deep enough to go to the World Series. Yeah, I guess you can slash that revenge, but in the end, you still cost 8 games. And again, I'll applaud Joe Kelly for doing it, but also applaud Manfred and the league for giving the suspension. You can't keep throwing at players.
I tend to agree with you on this one, Professor. I think it was better that the Dodgers were the first team to throw at the Astros than the Mariners because,
well, remember,
yeah,
Kansas City was the first team.
That's true. Kansas City did that in that exhibition game right before the season. I feel like the Dodgers had a lot more on their chest heading into this matchup than the Mariners did against the Astros. Yeah, the Mariners went 1-18 against Houston in 2019, but what kind of message would have been sent if it were, say, like Matt McGill? Mariners really were throwing at the Astros. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have meant much. Since it's a Dodgers reliever, that message gets sent and saying, hey, we don't forget the 2017 World Series. We don't forget what you guys may or may not have done in that World Series to beat us in 7 games. So because of that, we're still holding a grudge against you guys. And I think that's one of the big things in this is that, you know, the Dodgers, 3 years after the fact, have not forgotten. And a lot of players have changed sides in that locker room, and yet they still it's fresh in their minds. So, I'm not so broken up about the fact that the Mariners weren't the first team to go after the Astros. Also, John, on the report card, an interesting story today in the Oregonian, who has routinely been reporting on Larry Scott and just the misfalls of the Pac-12. Well, they reported today that the Pac-12 signed an agreement in 2018 to fund positive news coverage from the Los Angeles Times. Now, John, this is a pretty big ethical dilemma here, because the Los Angeles Times, being one of the biggest newspapers in the country, you know, they got to be fair and balanced in their coverage of everything that they cover. And yet it would appear as though the Pac-12 was funneling money towards them in order to get a positive spin on the Pac-12 and the conference as a whole. So how are we grading this another shortfall from the Pac-12?
Yeah, I mean, I give it an F. I mean, that's just, you're ruining the integrity of the paper. I mean, you're basically saying now since 2018, we're going to suck up to the Pac-12 and make them look good because they are not good in the way that they run things, and we're going to all favor them. And, you know, everybody else in the country, is just basically trying to report. I mean, you're supposed to be neutral. That's the job. I mean, for example, I know that, I can't root for a team because, again, I'm a reporter. And the reporters at the L.A. Times, you've got to be embarrassed by this. This is absolutely atrocious. In fact, I'm giving it an F minus, minus, minus.
Yeah, I'm giving it an F as well. I mean, what a disaster the Pac-12 has been from a PR standpoint over the last couple of years. And it all points to one person. It points to Larry Scott. And I cannot believe that the Pac-12 university presidents continue to employ this guy as the commissioner of your conference when time and time again it gets dragged through the mud and instances like this get found out where it just looks so poor on everybody's part, and yet they still just trudge along as though nothing happened. This is a major, major breach of ethics, and I don't think anybody should be okay with this, especially anybody in a Pac-12 university, because you're paying for positive news coverage. Why not generate something worthy of positive news coverage on your own? The only people that have to pay for positive news coverage are those in organizations that are poorly run, and the Pac-12 is clearly poorly run. So F all around for that one.
Yeah, and to make matters worse, it's like, okay, so here's how bad it is. The Pac-12 is considered, what, 5 in the Power 5, and they have to pay extra money to get good publicity for a conference that gets constantly ripped. I mean, you're ripping off money that could be used for better causes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then finally, John, on the report card, we get another Power 5 conference moving towards a conference-only schedule. That would be the ACC, which I think a lot of people would put as either number 2 or number 3 among the Power 5, whether it be interchangeable with the Big Ten. But the ACC announcing they will go with a conference-only schedule in 2020, and they'll also add Notre Dame to the conference for 2020. How are we grading just this wave of conference-only schedules in college football?
Well, I'm going to give it a B+. And the reason is, it's just now telling you that whether it's right, whether it's wrong, they're going to try to go ahead with college football. I mean, right now we're down to 8 conferences in the FCS that are still trying to vie for it. And I would imagine the Power 5 are just going to try to do it. I mean, you've already got, and you know, you can see that the SEC hasn't made a decision, but they'll start to want to see if they can play starting in September. Now, again, it may be ill-advisable. A lot of people may get sick because of this. But again, I guess, you know, you can see that now there's a better than not chance that college football is going to be there. And so I guess we can say that's good, because it's another sport that's coming back, even though it could have some problems. Now, again, you know, if that's the case, they still haven't decided about fans in the stands. You know, you hope that for the most part, most of the municipalities will say very few fans in the stands. But I guess it's good from the standpoint that college football may be back.
Yeah, I'm going to give these conferences, I'll give them a B for just being able to make a decision on their own. I give the NCAA an F for them not even ruling on anything. They've just remained quiet throughout. Mark Emmert has sat in his ivory tower and has not made any sort of hardline stance on anything over the last couple of months. I give the NCAA an F on this, and shout out to the conferences for actually getting something done without the NCAA. And you wonder, John, could these conferences survive without the ruling, the governance of the NCAA? Makes you wonder about things moving forward.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. So stay tuned. It's just kind of crazy. But, of course, be sure to check out the Professor's Notes on 710sports.com. Professor's Notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at Fife. Coming up next, we go into Busy Heart Seltzer text line and check your text questions at 710-710. John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
It's time to go into Busy Heart Seltzer text line, taking your text questions at 710-710. So, Curtis, what do we have?
John, let's go to the 509. They want to know, is Adam Vinatieri a Hall of Fame candidate?
Ultimately, yeah. I mean, but unfortunately, it just takes so much time for a kicker to get in. I mean, look all how long it took Morten Andersen. I mean, here's Vinatieri being so good for so long at two different championship-type teams in New England and Indianapolis. But it always comes down to this. A kicker going against a player, the player is going to win. A player versus a coach, the player is going to win. Now, of course, we're going to get a coaching category that should be able to pass sometime in this next month. That'll be good. But we don't have a special teams category, nor do I think we should. Again, is he a Hall of Fame kicker? Yes. Is he going to get in the Hall of Fame? It's going to take some time.
From the 206, they want to know, John, of all the NFL drafts you have covered, which one was your favorite?
I have to go back to 1974 because it was just phenomenal that the Steelers, ended up getting four Hall of Famers out of that, and then eventually an undrafted guy in Donnie Shell. But I mean, it was just amazing. Mike Webster was in that draft, and you got Stallworth and Swan and Lamb. It was just an amazing draft. So that, I guess to be fortunate, here I was 19, 20 years old, covering one of the greatest drafts probably in NFL history.
From the 360, they want to know, John, if Seattle signs Josh Gordon, how many receivers will they keep on the 53-man roster?
I honestly think they're only going to keep five. I mean, because I think they'll still want to keep an extra linebacker. Of course, now knowing that you can take Jamal Adams and play him a little bit at linebacker, that could hurt Shaquem Griffin. Because you want to keep. I think they'd like to keep seven linebackers. They probably keep nine offensive linemen because technically, Bruce Irvin's probably going to count in the linebacking group, and he can switch over to defensive end and all that stuff. But ultimately, it's going to come down to. But I think probably five because you want to have the four running backs and also a fullback. So I think it may be as few as five, even though last year they had as many as seven.
206 wants to know, John, what are your predicted order of standings in the NFC West?
Right now, I have a slight edge for San Francisco, but it's pretty close. That next move or non-move or injury or something like that, certainly it doesn't help that Deebo Samuel is not going to be able to start the season at wide receiver because of his Jones fracture, and now they're going to have to be younger with and a little less certain, and they end up trading Marquise Goodwin, that hurt. Emmanuel Sanders ended up leaving. So they're weaker at wide receiver, and they're not as good at defensive tackle without DeForest Buckner. But, Seattle, I think, is getting stronger. But my deal on it is the next move Seattle makes over San Francisco could put them over the top with the Arizona Cardinals finishing third and the Rams finishing fourth.
From the 253, they want to know, what is the percentage chance you think Jadeveon Clowney re-signs with Seattle?
It's maybe 40. I mean, it's got to say near 50 because really they think there's only technically two teams involved. Like, for example, some people were trying to put together something for the Patriots, but the Patriots don't like to pay, and Bill Belichick doesn't like to pay defensive ends. I mean, he's not going to go to Jadeveon Clowney's number. Now, again, if it's going to be a discounted type of deal, he will do that. But if it's a discounted type of deal, I mean, if you're Clowney, you're better served to come back to Seattle or consider Tennessee, because right now you've got to wonder, how good are the Patriots going to be, you know, now that almost their entire team is down? I mean, look, they've lost so many starters. I mean, six guys opted out. You know, Tom Brady's gone. They lost four key guys to free agency. I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah, they don't look anything similar to what we've expected from New England over the last 20 years or so. From the 360, they want to know, John, Seattle was 23rd in sacks allowed last season. So with all the new additions on the offensive line, you think Seattle will finish above or below 23rd next year?
I think they might go 20. I mean, because again, you've got a quarterback who likes to run and run around, and he's great at doing it. And you can see he's number one or number two quarterback in the league, but he's still exposed to do that. That's why I think that the idea of having let everything go with let him run, it's like, I think it's better to have a running offense. That I don't buy the total. I think they should definitely do some definite more things with the passing game, but the let Russ cook theory is going to lead to more sacks. If they let Russ cook in a running offense, there'll be less sacks.
206 wants to know, John, will Seattle's revamped secondary allow for the defensive line to get more pressure on quarterbacks?
I think so, yeah, because, I mean, and also if the defensive line can get some pressure, it will allow them to play more man, and playing more man, if it's going to be good quality man, which I think it's going to be, that's going to allow more sacks. I mean, I just, even though it's I go against that Clowney or bust type of thing, it'd be great if they can get Clowney, because if they get Clowney, they are way over the top. You can actually say that they're over New Orleans as far as talent, because now you're talking, seven top 100 players. I mean, you're talking 11 or 12 Pro Bowlers. I mean, they are really good. But, I still think that this is a much better defense than people are giving it credit for.
425 wants to know if you think Rob Gronkowski will play beyond the 2020 season.
Debatable. I think it's a year-to-year thing. I think there's a decent chance he might, just because Tom Brady's going to play next year, so he might as well play next year. I think he's going to like the Tampa experience, and I think they have a chance to be pretty good. So I think he'll give it one more year after this.
253, they want to know, how effective do you expect Damian Lewis to be in his rookie season?
I think he has a chance. I mean, again, you have to see, because nobody knows. He's not been here. This is going to be the first chance. I mean, he just got here 2 days ago. But I think he has a chance to be a starter. We'll see how the competition goes. But that competition, unfortunately, is not going to start until August 17th when they can put the pads on.
Yeah, I think they think highly of him because they let go DJ Fluker at that spot. So, should be interesting to watch Damian Lewis in his rookie season. From the 206, John, they want to know, what was the most absurd ranking in this year's top 100 list?
That's a good question. I think that I thought that they had Alvin Kamara too low. I mean, the running back stuff, I think, to me, was the one that I thought was kind of different, because they really kind of juggled the running backs a lot. I thought that a lot of the offensive line stuff, I think, was there. To have Logan Ryan number 60 and have him, he hasn't got a contract yet, and it's not because he's holding to a high number. I mean, it's like he hasn't got any offers, I mean, other than maybe the Jets. So having him at 60, that's a little bit high. Certainly having Myles Garrett at 80, that's ridiculous. That's too low for the second highest paid player in the National Football League on defense. I mean, that's a little bit low. So I thought that wasn't too good. I think they had Chris Jones too low at 52. So there's a bunch of them that I don't necessarily agree with.
Yeah, Todd Gurley at 51, that's way too high. Yeah, how do you have Myles Garrett in the 80s? That guy is one of the best defensive players in the league.
Yeah, he just got $25 million. It's like, come on.
Yeah, that guy's at least top 30, maybe top 20.
What are we thinking?
Yeah. This isn't rocket science, folks. No. Let's simplify. From the 509, John, they want to know, do you think the Vegas Raiders have a chance to compete for a playoff spot in 2020?
No. I think they're going to fall short. Do they have a chance to compete? Yes. But I still think they're more a year away. I mean, you know, because now, but you know, like anything else in the AFC, it's, you know, you do have experienced quarterbacks because they have two in Derek Carr and Marcus Mariota. They are better at linebacker. They're probably a little bit better on defense. I mean, they have a chance. And again, it's a wild card because, you know, none of the three teams in that division are going to catch Kansas City. So yeah, they'd have a chance for a wild card.
Is this year three for
year
Gruden?
Three? Correct. Yeah.
Okay, year three. I don't wonder if the seat's getting a little hot in Vegas. No pun intended.
He's got a
for
10-year guarantee.
That's true. Yeah, $100 million.
$100 million for 10 years. I don't. Let's put it this way: if that seat's hot, it's probably on somebody else, yeah. Not John Gruden.
That is it for today's text questions.
Okay, time for our daily dose of the Groz with Dave Grosby. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the Professor John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And it's time for our Daily Dose of the Groz with Dave Grosby. And so, David, I guess we did get finally some action from baseball in the sense that, you know, they did take the pitcher and, you know, give Joe Kelly and give him an 8-game suspension. And, you know, I have to give a good grade to Rob Manfred and the league on this one because, you know, particularly after that Kansas City fiasco where they started out with, you know, a Kansas City pitcher throwing three times at Astro batters, there was nothing that happened there and something should have been there. But it's like, okay, everybody's warned. That's why I thought it was wise for the Mariners not to use one of their pitchers to throw at the Astros because, you know, trying to win games, develop talent, and, you know, with only 10 starts for your starting pitcher and a 6-man staff, it would have been unwise. But I have to give him a good grade on the 8-game suspension.
I thought it was way too severe. It would, so I disagree with you on it. It would have been 22 games. It was a regular season of 162 games. It was an overreaction. Half of that number might have been okay, especially because you can't throw at a guy's head. You know, the 8 games was in a 60 game season was too much, I thought, and it especially points out the fact that none of those Astro players got any suspensions at all for cheating. So, that kind of blew things up a little bit. I thought, look, he said he was going to be severe, and he was. Just in my opinion, it was too much.
Yeah, but you're right about that. I mean, the number of games, but I still think it had to be something significant because, you know, that takes him down to only, you know, knocks him out of 2 starts for the most part. But, you know, something had to happen, and I think that, you know, the warning was out there. If you do that, I mean, fortunately, it's a Dodger team, which is one of the deepest in baseball, so they can probably survive it. But, you know, that hurts the team, but that's why I thought it was wise for the Mariners not to do anything.
Well, I mean, the Mariners didn't really have an axe to grind, I suppose, although Marco Gonzalez is one of the guys that pointed it out. And, you know, pitching inside is one thing. But, you know, like I said, I think half would have been good. 4 games would have been the equivalent of 11, which is a significant suspension. And we'll see if it has the desired impact, which is for everyone to move on. Although I saw baseball got a little bit of bad news. Some Phillies personnel, tested positive today who are in the visiting locker room there. So they've got that on their hands. Another Marlins player tested positive as well. So they can't spend much time dwelling on it because they've got other issues.
Yeah, no doubt. And that is a problem. And of course, you know, who knows how long it's going to take for the Marlins to come back. They're now up to 17 players that have tested positive, 19 people in the organization.
Yeah, unbelievable. And, you know, in that, with that backdrop of not doing a bubble, the NBA is ready to start with all their guys in a bubble, and basically we're going to see if this particular experiment works starting tonight with a doubleheader, with the 8-game regular season, and then a full-on playoffs, which should be interesting. But, you know, hockey's doing the same thing with their bubble up north in Canada. And I know the NFL will be watching very closely and with a lot of interest as to how this works. They obviously haven't gone with the bubble. They're going with what baseball did, and we'll see if they can learn some lessons from basketball and hockey restarting.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And that's one thing, is the advantage for the NFL is that you know, they have that time because they don't play until September to kind of watch. And, you know, thinking through things, and I didn't get a chance. I wasn't offered the opportunity to listen to the Zoom broadcast with Bobby Wagner yesterday in the interview. But the thing that I thought was interesting, what he brought out, and I think because of the Marlins, is that leadership is going to be so important, because what you need is your players and your team and the coaches to go to the players and say, listen, don't go out. Give us the 4 months. These 4 months are important because you only do damage to your teammates, yourself, your family, and all those different things. And so find a way to make this work. And so thinking of that, I was thinking, some people think, they'd like to have KJ Wright as a cap casualty. No, I think he's too important right now because, one, he's a player rep. Two, he's a good leader on the team. And you go and you look at the team's leadership right now. They've got good leadership. I think when you'll get Jamal Adams, they'll have it right now with Quandre Diggs, Wright, Bobby Wagner. You got Dwayne Brown on the offensive line, Tyler Lockett, Russell Wilson, and those guys can stress to the players, the young players, don't betray us. Don't go out.
I agree, and I thought it was interesting, too, that the Bills, I know, sent their rookies home today, so some teams are making the exact adjustment that you're talking about. That's your big concern is your young players, and discipline is going to be of paramount importance. And to have guys like that, veterans like that, I agree, is going to be important all around the league for every team. And I wouldn't be surprised if some other teams follow the lead of the Bills, especially when it comes to younger players. But I certainly agree with you, John, in terms of the KJ Wright aspect of it. Keep veterans around. The teams that are smart in camp are going to be the teams that are successful. And you're right. I mean, you've got a tremendous responsibility to everyone else in the league beyond yourself if you're a younger player.
Mm-hmm, no doubt. And that's why I think that, trying to make sure that you work well with the players and try to do it because, leadership, you could lead with coaching and this team has great coaching. Okay. But you could also lead with the players and, they can all work together because I think you can see, particularly with the moves that were made for this team, they are really ramping up for a 2-year run at the Super Bowl.
No doubt. And, definitely certainly a run this year is what they're planning on and what they're counting on. And I think it's, I don't know that the coaches can have that much control over what guys do when they're not around. It really does come down to the players and leadership on the player side, to send those important messages. And the Seahawks have been lucky during the Pete Carroll era and even before that, they've had some good leaders and for the most part, as an organization have been able to, in general, avoid the kind of off-field stuff that has really plagued some other franchises, and it's served them very well.
No doubt, and that's why I think it's going to be, a good leadership is going to be so important, particularly if you make a bad move with us, you're costing us the chance to maybe go to the Super Bowl. And then, of course, what we still don't know is how many more players are going to opt out, how many are going to be suffering injuries.
Exactly right. And what training camp is going to look like and, what the reaction is going to be the first time that there are some positive tests, which probably every team is going to have to deal with at some point. It seems inevitable that that's going to happen, and it's kind of a voyage of discovery for every single team. And the teams that I do think will have the advantage are the teams that have some veteran leadership to move forward with.
Yeah, no doubt. And, of course, that's so important. So how good do you think the Seahawks team can be?
I think, when you've got a quarterback like they have and the weapons that he's got around him and big time players on both sides of the ball, you've got the opportunity. I mean, it'll all come down to how healthy they can be when the season comes to an end. We all know that. But if they can avoid the injury plague that got them at the end of last year, I think that there's no reason to think that, you take this team, put Russell Wilson in the playoffs with a couple of weapons and you take your shot and you got a very good shot at it. So I think they position themselves well to make that 2-year run you're talking about.
Yeah, no doubt. And of course, where I say the 2-year run, what's so important about that is that, next year, in fact, I was counting it up last night. There are currently 17 teams over the $175 million floor cap, 17 teams. And a league right now that usually you go at this time of the year, you have about $1 billion available as far as cap on the top 51.
Right.
They're actually under. and that's how bad it is. And Seattle's like about 13 under, and so they have a chance to make all that up. And I think they can be in pretty good shape because they can make more moves than anybody else, and they only have a couple of free agents that are key to re-sign. Now we'll see about the older guys like KJ Wright and all that stuff, but what's Quentin Dunbar, if you can get him on the field, Shaquille Griffin and Chris Carson, and one of those guys can get franchised.
Get it done this year, then you don't have to worry about a two-year plan.
Exactly. That'll be good. And, of course, our plan every day is to have the Daily Dose of the Groz with Dave Grosby. And so, Dave, thanks for joining us.
John, enjoy your day. We'll talk tomorrow.
Okay, and, of course, we will be back tomorrow. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.